My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris and thank you for joining us for our first episode in over a year, just a few weeks back, looking at Pink Floyd's fantastic album Animals, and thanks to Frank Carducci for joining me for that one. That and of course all of our previous episodes right back to 2017 are all available at myclassicalbum.co.uk. Wherever you listen to your podcasts, of course. And don't forget, you can also listen to us at Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. It was a really fun episode. It was really nice to get back into the swing of things. And it's one of those things where obviously I'd spent over a year not producing the podcasts for one reason or another, thinking to myself, are people going to be bothered that it's back? Are people going to care? And I needn't have worried because it was easily one of the most listened to episodes that we've ever had on the podcast. And I know that Frank's fans really enjoyed it. But I think, you know, what I've noticed is that a lot of people really started listening to the podcast during the lockdown this year. 2020 has been a really strange year. And I think podcasting has become bigger than ever in that time. And people have gone back, listened to the old episodes. We've had some awesome guests, some awesome albums over the years. Over the next few weeks, some fantastic guests, some that I can tell you about, some that I can't, obviously. Keep an eye on the social media channels, because I like to post once I've chatted to them, and it's all confirmed. I like to post who I've been chatting with, but get yourself on Facebook, My Classic Album with Mike Norris, and follow the page. Get yourself on Instagram, My Classic Album Podcast. Or alternatively, you could absolutely follow me on Twitter. Not that I'm on there very much, but that is certainly something you can do, at @MCA_podcast. All of the information about the podcast, including latest guests, latest episodes, all of that kind of stuff, is available on www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. I think what I'm very excited about at the moment, today's episode is going to be fantastic. We are chatting with Noosh Skougan about Carly Simon's breakthrough album, No Secrets, and it's a really cool chat. Nice album that I'd never heard before until Noosh suggested it. So I always like it when it's an album that I've never really heard much. And to be able to dig into that and find out the story was really interesting for me. The album in a couple of weeks' time is one that I'm very familiar with. And of course, I announced this on the last episode of My Classic Album. We're going to be celebrating 45 years at the Opera in 2 weeks' time. We're going to be looking at the fantastic breakthrough album from Queen. That the album that kind of sent them over the top, if you like, A Night at the Opera. Released in 1975, and one of my favourite guests of all time for the podcast has come back to help me celebrate such a momentous occasion, Savannah Pope, who you may remember joined me to break down the soundtrack to the Rocky Horror Picture Show last year, is here in a couple of weeks' time to chat with me about a fantastic album in A Night at the Opera. But then I would be biased because I'm a huge Queen fan. But, you know, great opportunity to celebrate a fantastic anniversary for a fantastic album, especially when Queen are making a lot of headlines at the moment, you know, with their live album with Adam Lambert going to number one and still doing their thing. But we'll be very much focusing on the classic lineup of Queen, Freddie Mercury, Brian May, Roger Taylor and John Deacon recording what some would say is their truly classic album in just a couple of weeks' time. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this album, as we always do with anniversary episodes. To be fair, I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of our albums, but we really dig down in the anniversary episodes and I read out a lot of your thoughts and your opinions and your memories, anything surrounding this album. Please get in touch with that information if you want it to be shared on the podcast. Again, those social media channels, you know, searching for My Classic Album with Mike Norris on Facebook, My Classic Album Podcast on Instagram, at @MCA_podcast on Twitter. Share those memories with me. Anything that we can do to kind of celebrate the legacy of this fantastic album. And one thing that's also going to be taking place, which is should be on the social media channels by now, by the time that you're listening to this, is a bit of a poll around your favourite song on the album. Perhaps the elephant in the room is Bohemian Rhapsody. I presume people think that it's going to storm it, the greatest song on the album, and maybe it will, but if that's not your favourite song on the album, and I know a couple of people on the social media channels have been saying, well, actually, I don't think Bohemian Rhapsody is the best song on Night at the Opera, make your voice heard, vote for it on the poll, it'll be on all the social media channels. I want to hear your favourite song, and it's funny because we've done this sometimes with previous albums, so for example, Bat Out of Hell, I presumed that Bat Out of Hell would win that, and it was actually For Crying Out Loud. So I think Def Leppard as well, we did it with Hysteria, and I think Gods of War won. So it's, you know, it's not always the obvious tracks that win something like that. Bohemian Rhapsody is going to be the solid favourite, but if you prefer the song, if you love the Prophet song, if you love You're My Best Friend, I'm In Love With My Car, whatever, get voting. You've got 2 weeks to get that in. And as I say, your memories, your votes, all of that, and my chat with Savannah will be on 45 Years at the Opera in a couple of weeks' time. But let's go a couple of years back. You know, that's 1975. The album we're talking about today is a little earlier in the 1970s. And we're kind of approaching this sort of singer-songwriter. You know, we've done these kinds of albums before. The likes of Joni Mitchell and Carole King and James Taylor. Carly Simon was very much kind of part of that movement. But in this album, she went off a little bit on her own, embracing a bit more of a poppy side, thanks to her producer. And obviously, I'm going to be talking about that in quite a lot of detail with my guest today, Noosh Kaughan, who chose the album. We're going to get to my chat with Noosh in just a little bit, but before we do, let's have a look at the facts. Here's what you need to know about No Secrets. Singer-songwriter Carly Simon released her third studio album, No Secrets, on the 28th of November 1972. The album came hot off the heels of her second album, Anticipation, and was released by Elektra Records. Elektra requested that Richard Perry, who had already collaborated with the likes of Barbara Streisand and Harry Nilsson, produce the album, and production shifted to Trident Studios in London. Richard's influence on the album led to a more pop-orientated sound for Carly, moving away from her contemporaries Joni Mitchell and Carole King. This was most evident in Carly's breakthrough single You're So Vain, which reached number one in countries including the US, Canada and Australia. The single also saw success in the UK, reaching number three, and quickly became Carly's defining moment in her career. Second single, The Right Thing to Do, saw top 20 success, reaching number 17 on both the US Billboard and UK singles chart. The success of the Grammy award-winning You're So Vain was matched by the album, reaching number one on the US Billboard 200, contributing to it becoming the fourth highest selling album of 1973. No Secrets reached number three on the UK album charts, giving it gold certification alongside its platinum status stateside. No Secrets proved to be Carly Simon's breakthrough moment, and the album is still highly regarded today. You're So Vain was ranked as Billboard's 72nd greatest song of all time in 1994, while Gilt Vallon included No Secrets as a whole in the 300 plus best albums in the history of rock in 2013. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about No Secrets, and I have here with me my special guest who chose the album to talk about here today. This is Noosh Kaughan. How's it going?
Good, thanks, Mike. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. And just before we get into it, and I know we were just talking before we kind of started chatting here, there were a few classic albums that we've already touched on that you would love to have chatted about today. Why have you chosen No Secrets to talk about on My Classic Album here today?
I mean, I just think it was a big influence in my life. You know what I mean? Like, in the beginning, I was very much folk influence, and I think Carly... And now I'm doing rock and roll, like it kind of like grew into a rock, you know, becoming a rock and roll artist. But I think Carly just exemplifies that classic album that has the folk roots about it. And like the really great lyrics, really great storytelling. I mean, we'll get into it as we talk about it, but it was just like, it's like, you know, above par on all levels. And the musicians are amazing. And it's a band record, which is how I've always made my records as well. So I suppose I related to her when I first listened to the album, which I cannot remember when I first listened to it, by the way. I was like, when did I first listen to this? I have no idea. But yeah, I was probably in my early teens, to be honest, when I first listened to it. But yeah, she's got that rock and roll edge to the album, but it's still very much based on great storytelling and great lyrics and great musicianship and played live with her band. So I just think, yeah, that's why I chose it. It's just a classic, amazing album where all the songs stand apart.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because obviously one of the questions we'd usually ask at this point, and I think sometimes this is the sign of a good album, because either you remember exactly where you were when you heard it for the first time, or it becomes so ingrained in the fabric of who you are that you don't, and, exactly. then it's just part of you. Is that more what it's like for you? Like, you can't particularly remember when it was, it's just almost felt like it's always been around.
Yeah, exactly. I think I listened to it so much, I think, like I said, like in my early teens and then growing into it, that I just can't remember the first time. But I think the first song I would have heard was You're So Vain. I mean, I'm pretty sure that would have been the first song. But yeah, and then obviously I would have delved into the record. But yeah, I think it's just gone. Yeah, exactly like you said, it's ingrained into you because you played it so much that like you just have no idea when was the first time. It's not like a memory of when I was, yeah, that was where I was and that was who I was then. It's just become part of my musical history, I suppose.
And I know you were saying, obviously, there's certainly kind of folky influences in your music. It's been kind of, obviously, your new album's a lot more kind of rock and roll. And I think it's funny because my classic album's been a bit like that and that we've covered loads of classic rock and heavy rock. But then there's occasional albums like this, which fall much more into that folky singer-songwritery kind of genre. But we've not done any for a while, which is why I was really pleased that we were looking at this album today. And I think the early 70s were just this amazing time for singer-songwriters coming into their own. And, you know, we've looked back at Joni Mitchell's Blue. We've looked at Carole King's Tapestry, Sweet Baby James by James Taylor. These were all released around the same time, maybe, you know, give or take a year or two before No Secrets. What makes No Secrets and indeed Carly Simon stand out amongst these great singer-songwriters that were all breaking out around the same time?
I mean, I think the main thing with Carly is that at that time, it was, you know, it was women folk singers were singing about particular things and in a certain way. And Carly, I think, for the first time, walked that thin line musically between having some rock and roll edgy elements, which I think Richard Perry obviously brought that influence on her. So it was the folksy background that she came from and that she was clinging on to so hard. to maintain, and yet you have a producer involved who has a particular vision for the record. And then lyrically, yeah, I think it was probably one of the first records that was very much very female empowering at the time. If you think back to the 70s, you know, like female artists weren't treated the same way as male artists, as in any aspect of life at that point, you know, in terms of jobs and everything. And I think it was the first time where a woman singer from the folk scene actually was like, she sang about empowering the women instead of like being the victim or singing about really nice things or different things. You know, she has some strength to what she was saying and conviction. And I think that's what makes the lyrics so strong.
Yeah. And I think as we look back on that time in music, and, you know, we've talked a little bit already about Carole King and Joni Mitchell. There was actually a book written back in 2008 by an author called Sheila Weller, who wrote about all three of them. And the book is called Girls Like Us, Carole King, Joni Mitchell and Carly Simon, and The Journey of a Generation. And this is what she says about the role all three of them played in that development of kind of the female singer-songwriter. She said, Carole King, Joni Mitchell and Carly Simon were born in the early 1940s, came of age in the late 60s, and became important singer-songwriters when that concept was in its infancy. From their very disparate backgrounds, they jointly pioneered the idea of the female artist adventurer. You've already touched on kind of how your roots are very much kind of in that kind of folky area. How important is the influence of all three of these artists, but obviously particularly Carly, as we're talking about her today, in your personal journey as an artist?
Yeah, I mean, actually, all three of them, I was going to say, I mean, Carole King's Tapestry and Joni Mitchell's album Blue, I mean, yeah, those were probably one of the first few records, along with Carly's, that I listened to. And yeah, they've all been very influential on me, I think, because they really sang about, like, real things. They were very honest. I think that's the whole thing about folk music. It's not pretentious.
Yeah.
You have to write songs that come from your own experience in life and from the heart. You kind of have to be really vulnerable and be willing to put yourself out there in the world, which is, it's just a really hard thing to do, I think, for a lot of people, you know, bearing your soul and bearing your heart. But as artists, especially singer-songwriters, that's our job. You know, that's what, if you want to be a singer-songwriter, you've got to write about your own life and your own things. And you can, you know, allude to it or, like, you know, make it more poetic if you like as well, you know, so it's not so obvious. But I think the core of it, when you write a song, it has to come from you. And I mean, most of the time, a really great song is like you're feeling something so strongly, like emotionally it's in you, and you just have to pick up the guitar, or for Carly, a piano or guitar, you know, and just get it out of you. You know, it's like kind of you vomit the the experience of what you're feeling, and it happens really quickly when it's a song that comes from who you really are. When you're struggling to find a theme or a subject, you're like, shit, I've got 8 songs on the album, and the producer says I've got to write another 2, you know, and you're like, shit, I've just got to get on with it, and you're kind of under pressure to do it, and you just try and find subjects. I think that's when, for me personally anyway, that's when I can get into a writer's block, and it's hard. It's more when it just flows, and that's when you know it's a good song. When you're starting to pick it apart and trying to, you know, get this lyric to rhyme with that, because you can't, you're just getting more in your head. Does that make sense? Like, when you get into your head as a writer, it's just, that's not where it comes from. It has to come from the heart. So yeah, to get back to these three women, I think they're absolutely phenomenal. And obviously Carly, as we're speaking about Carly today, just, you know, the strength to put her heart on the line, and also, you know, with conviction. For the women at that time, it would have empowered a lot of women, which is phenomenal. And that's our job as artists as well, is to empower people. So that's, I think, what Carly did, possibly more than Jodie or Carol. You know, that was her kick, especially on this record. I'm talking specifically about this record, No Secrets.
Yeah, and I think at this point in the early 70s, you know, Carly's just released a second album, Anticipation, the year before. And that does, yeah, as you've said, and we're going to talk about Richard Perry a little bit more shortly, but, you know, I think Anticipation was a much folkier album, very kind of acoustic feel to it. No Secrets does start to venture into kind of more of a pop rock territory, almost.
Yeah.
Have you listened to Anticipation, and do you agree that by No Secrets we're starting to hear this kind of almost like an evolution in Carly's sound?
Oh, for sure. It totally, like, she evolved her sound, as every artist does. You never want to make the same record twice. You know, it's like, you've done it. You're like, what's next? You know, I think we always have to keep evolving and keep pushing. So I think it's always the next, where she wanted to go next, basically, how she wanted to push things and push boundaries and experiment with certain sounds. And yeah, I think you always want to push for that next sound. It's still your sound, essentially, because, you know, it's still coming from her. But obviously everything that influences it is where you record it, the studios, musicians that you're with, and above all, the producer, especially if it's a producer with a vision, rather than, say, a Bruce Springsteen record where he would pretty much produce his own stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, he had a vision for it, and he was very much his own producer, I think. I think when you have a producer who's there and that's his job, is to create the vision, it's very collaborative, and he has a big influence on it as well, on the sound, you know. So you have to trust your producer completely if he's someone like that.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what's interesting is that actually, you know, when the sessions began, before they moved over to London, you know, they actually did some sessions with Paul Buckmaster, who was originally going to produce the album. He ended up doing some orchestral arrangements on the final album. Those initial sessions, they featured James Taylor on kind of backing vocals, Danny Kortchmar on guitar. But Elektra actually rejected those tracks, and they specifically asked Carly to work with Richard Perry. Do you know much of Richard's work beyond the No Secret album? How big, I know we're talking about the impact that the producer can have on the sound, just how big an impact do you think Richard has on this album in comparison to certainly the earlier Carly Simon albums?
I think he's had, yeah, definitely a stronger impact on this album than he would have had on the other albums. I mean, he did produce, if I remember correctly, Barbara Streisand and Diana Ross and people like that, who have, you know, it's a very different genre to what Carly does and what she was doing. So I think, yeah, I think if you look at her previous albums and you listen to this album, you can definitely hear the difference and the evolution of her as an artist. So definitely he had, I didn't know that Elektra made her work with him. she's like, yeah, this is what's happening. You are working with him, this dude. That must be tough though for her. That must have been tough for her, because kind of giving up your baby to someone that you don't really want to work with. But that's the funny thing. I think oftentimes you don't particularly want to work with someone, but as you do it, I mean, this was such an incredible success and such a breakthrough album for her, that it's a magical record, and it wouldn't have happened without the two of them together. So I feel like sometimes you just have to trust the universe and trust your record label, even though you don't agree. You're like, yeah, okay, I'm going to do this. Because sometimes, yeah, there is some things that we don't see as artists. We don't see the match and the vision where it could go with someone else with very differing opinions. But yeah, as you know, the proof is in the pudding. You know, when you listen to the record, it's phenomenal.
And I think to use an example that's a world away from this album, but another album we've covered in the past, to think about the Black Album by Metallica. Bob Rock produced that album. Again, there's like video footage of them like arguing in the studio, this massive change in musical direction, yet that still to this day is their best selling album. So sometimes just this fresh face coming in, this new perspective on things can really shake things up sometimes.
Absolutely. And it's good because especially she was using the same band, I believe, that she'd had before. So it's like you get into a groove, you know, you'll find this, the same licks, the same guitar, you know, guitar riffs, like the drum will just go into is like you get into your habits, mm-hmm. which is nice as a band, but it's not necessarily pushing you as an artist or making the songs the best they can be. So, yeah, totally. I think that independent perspective of someone that you don't necessarily have to like them, but you have to respect them. You have to like respect their work and respect what they're doing and respect that they could elevate it to another level, you know, and as long as you're still in that space. And I think that's where she was with Richard, even though she in the beginning she fought it, you know, and everything that, and she said she fought it all the way actually. But I think that sometimes it's that, I mean, even for Rumours, they were like, you know, like, I mean, often bands are like behind the scenes or, you know, it's not going great, but the music that they create is, I think, a combination of all that tension. So the tension between Carly and Richard probably created this, and the musicians and everything, you know, instead of it being just another normal record, you know, it became this huge success, and probably some of the tension had something to do with it.
Yeah. Do you think, and again, this isn't me knocking an album like Blue, so obviously we've covered it before, I think it's, you know, it's an amazing album. I think Rolling Stone have recently redone their 500 greatest albums of all time, and they put Joni Mitchell's Blue at number 3, so I'm certainly not knocking the album by any stretch. Do you think, though, that with Richard's influence on this album, that No Secrets is a more accessible album than Blue?
I think it's more commercial. I mean, definitely. It's definitely more a commercial album. I mean, Blue is it's a piece of art, you know. It's definitely a phenomenal record and definitely wouldn't knock it.
it's
a great album. But I think this album, it has that radio feel to it, you know, where I don't think Blue is necessarily like that radio kind of album. Carly's You're So Vain, I mean, it's just such a radio track. You're just sitting in your car, you know, and you put the volume up and it just sounds great. And I think that might have been where I first heard it, maybe in a car or something, I don't know. But I think it's definitely a radio friendly record, you know, and I think that's why it's pop rock, you know, whereas Joni was very folk. She stayed in that folk genre, which had a completely different platform. Folk was like played in bars and small cafes, and it was more on the live scene, whereas you get the pop rock, you get the radio plays, you know, which then leads to the huge success it has. So yeah, I think that's the main difference. I think Carly's is it's more commercial than Joni Mitchell's Blue.
And I think while, you know, obviously we've talked about this, perhaps like almost a professional tension, you know, it sounds like that Carly and Richard have a really strong friendship to this day. And they talk about that in, and I think I'd sent it to you, I don't know if you've had a chance to watch it yet, but there's a fantastic documentary looking back on the making of the album through the Classic Album series. And Carly describes Richard as very dominating and very good. Richard always got his way, is what she says in that one, which I like. And in fact, Richard, as you kind of touched on, he brought in a lot of musicians to work on the album. So obviously Carly had certain people that she was used to working with. She was comfortable. Carly's drummer, Andy Newick, states that Richard just merely tolerated him. We'll give you guys a shot, but no guarantees. I need to make the record I need to make with my guys, and you need to be cool with that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I did watch the documentary a while ago now, but yeah, I vaguely do remember them. Yeah, he definitely said it was my way or the highway. You know, at the end of the day, the buck stops with me. But she did bring her guys over to London to do the records. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he did interchange. When he wasn't happy, he would bring in his own guys. So, I mean, that of course, that's going to create tension. You know, everyone has an ego in this business. As a musician, especially, it's your whole life. It's your work. It's your artwork. I mean, someone's not liking it, you take it personally, you know, and that's going to create tension in the studio. But at the end of the day, I guess that's what a producer is there for, to make sure he has the best musician playing the part possible on the record that fits the vibe of the song and the album, and not have them there just because they're mates. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's a really tough call as an artist to make. Like, I've been in those situations, you know, where I really dig my guitarist, but he wasn't the best one for the tour or the best one for the, or they might've been great for the tour or the shows, but not the greatest studio guitarist. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's some guitarists that just have this flair on stage. They know how to rock the crowd and there's a vibe between us on stage and stuff. And that's magical in itself, but they may not have that, you know, that little extra skill set, you know, which you need in the studio, or he might not get on with the bassist. Do you know what I mean? There's so many things that go, and you're like, and the thing is that if one person is not happy, it literally is like a bad egg. Like, it affects the whole project. Like, it's just, if one musician isn't happy or feels inadequate for any reason, it just brings the whole vibe of the project down. And you've got to be able to say, sorry mate, like, it's not working, like, love you but gotta leave you, you know what I mean? I had to do that on this record. It was a really, really tough call, but you know, and that was the producer who pointed it out. He pointed it out to me, and he was like, but you have to do it, you have to tell him. Like, I kind of respected, I think producers can point it out, but I think it's when it's your musicians that you brought on board and they're your mates. He was my mate from Nashville. It's much more personal to do it yourself. Like, it's really hard to fire someone. That's what a producer's there for, to make sure it's, you know, it's going to be the best record it can be, and not, you know, they're not just there for friendship, you know.
And obviously we've talked a little bit about how the album was recorded in London. Again, this was something that Richard was very much behind. You know, he wanted the album recorded in Trident Studios in London. So again, at Trident are very famous for kind of working with artists like David Bowie, Queen, the Beatles. So again, a lot of history in this studio that she's recording in. She appeared on the Old Grey Whistle test while she was recording the album, and she said she preferred living and working in London than New York, and that the studio should worked in London felt warmer than the studio where she'd recorded her first album. So we've talked about the importance of, you know, everybody getting along and everybody gelling and, you know, everybody kind of feeling part of the project. How important is the setting? So in terms of the studio itself, how vital is that to feel connected to that space that you're in when you're recording an album?
Oh, 100%. I mean, like, every studio has its own different vibe, and it affects how you feel. I mean, everything we do is so connected to our feelings and our spirit and our soul, you know, as artists and as musicians. If you walk into a studio and it's just like, it's got no vibe, no soul, the people aren't nice, you know, do you know what I mean? Which rarely happens, by the way. I'm, you know, I don't think I've ever walked into a studio where I've just been like, nope, I'm not recording it. But yeah, it definitely affects the energy. It's like the whole band, the producer, of everything. And then of course you have the equipment, and like, you know, do like, me personally, I love analog, so like they should have like all that old stuff, and you know, all the old analog equipment, and yeah, just making it nice and comfy for us, you know what I mean? Like bohemian carpets everywhere. Like, I wrote one, yeah, Jeff Schott, who's Sheryl Crow's like collaborator on a lot of her stuff, I wrote one of the songs with him, and his studio was just like this so boho vibe. Like, he just felt great walking into it, you know. And I'm sure Carly, did she want to work in London? No, that was Richard's call, wasn't it, that he wanted to work in London?
I think she was happy working there, but I think Richard was definitely the driving force in why they got there, but I think she was happy enough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because at the end of the day, you don't want to hate the place, but if you like hate London and you hate where you are, you know, you got to like what you're doing, because otherwise it's just not going to work. But yeah, so I think the environment is hugely important, you know, and each a band can record in one studio and make this phenomenal record, and then the same band can go into another studio and it just doesn't have the same, you know, there's like something magical that you can't really describe it. It's an energy, you know, so. Yeah, definitely. I agree with that. Yeah. Setting is very important.
Definitely. And I think, you know, we've talked a lot about Richard's kind of part in this. And obviously, we'll be talking a lot more about Carly, because we're about to go track by track shortly and get into kind of the songs one by one. But I think talking too much about Richard almost does a disservice to Carly herself, because at the end of the day, it's her album, they're her songs. And as we talked about at the top there, you know, she really was a huge part in establishing this template for what kind of the female singer-songwriter is almost to this day. And, you know, even massive pop stars today, like Taylor Swift, you know, Taylor Swift cites her as a huge influence. What is it that you think that Carly's doing on this album? And I know we've touched on this a little bit at the beginning, but what's she doing on this album that's still resonating for people like Taylor Swift and perhaps Adele and these big singer-songwriters to this day?
I mean, I think that at the time, like I touched on it before, but she was the first kind of female singer-songwriter to create an album that was very much about female empowerment, instead of being, you know, complaining, saying this guy's left me, being the victim, do you know what I mean, very kind of poor me side, you know, or the very descriptive folky side. This was more like, you know, especially songs like You're So Vain and stuff, it was just like calling a spade, you know, like this is what's going on. Or like, you know, other songs like where she's just being very honest and vulnerable about her relationship. It takes a strong woman to come out and just put that down on a page and then record it and then release it to the public, I think. And I think that's possibly what, like, female artists today, like Adele, like Taylor Swift and stuff, they're just, that people that respect that and people connect to that, you know, especially the women now, they're just connected to that powerful, I am who I am, you either like me or you don't. Do you know what I mean? It's very much you're confident and strong in who you are and as a woman. And I think that was really very new at the time in the 70s as a record to come out, and that's probably why it still lasted and it's one of the greatest albums today, because it has that feeling to it and it's inspired so many other female artists. So Carly and it all came from, you know, as she's talked about, like her own experiences and her own how she was feeling in her own relationships. And I think to have that strength and that confidence to put her heart on the line and do that you connect to that. There's no denying, you know, and I think that's, and if you listen to Adele now or something, it is very much love songs. It's very personal. I think that's what the record is. It's personal and it's strong. So yeah, I think that's what they're inspired by, essentially, and people aspire to be like her.
So let's go track by track, and obviously we'll get through these, because I think that some of them, again, there's some really interesting stories behind some of the songs on the album, and obviously we'll take plenty of time to have a chat about You're So Vain, because there's so much that kind of that we can unpick there. But let's start with the right thing to do. So this was written about Carly's relationship with James Taylor, and from what I can gather, she married him shortly after the album was finished, shortly before it was released, so kind of in that little kind of time period. We've touched on James Taylor a little bit, but of course he's a massive part of Carly's life. They were married for 10 years, they had two children together. Here, however, we're nearer the start of their relationship than the end. And I know Carly once said of this song, it was actually one of my absolutely undisputed songs about James, written 3 months into our relationship. What do you think of The Right Thing to Do as an opening track for the album? And what insight do you think it gives us into a relationship with James Taylor at this point?
Gosh, well, I think it's a great opening track. I think when you, like, she obviously, like, the order of the whole album is obviously been thought about intensely. And I think opening up with that track and being very open and honest about her relationship with James, and obviously it was early days for her when she wrote that song with him, it's just very honest. And she just put it out there. And I think it grabs the listener to want to listen to the rest of the record. So I think it was a great track to start with, for sure. And they were like the rock and roll couple, weren't they? Those two. With their two kids and their whole, like, rock and roll. I mean, both of them just massive artists in their own right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, obviously we'll touch more on, because there's certain elements of this album's production which, I guess, on the one hand led to some kind of problems between them, but on the other hand may even have kind of sparked that decision to get married. And we'll talk about that later in the album, because there's particular songs that would maybe touch on that. But Carly notes in the Classic Albums documentary that it was originally meant to be slower in tempo, but again, one of the things that Richard kind of really pushed for with this song was to speed it up. Do you think the song benefits from that kind of quicker, more upbeat tempo? Can you imagine it being a bit more kind of pulled back?
Yeah, I can imagine it being more pulled back, and I don't think that it would have had... I mean, she probably wrote it at a slower tempo, and this often happens in the studio, and you have it, because you've written it a certain way, you envision it being recorded that way and being played that way. And that's what, you know, a third eye, an objective person can do this. So let's speed it up. And sometimes I've done that, and it becomes this whole different song. And I think it grabs your attention much more. If I think if it was slower, it probably wouldn't have been the opening track, to be honest, because it is a little bit more upbeat, and it just grabs you and makes you want to listen to the rest of the record, because it is a little bit more upbeat. But yeah, tempo can totally change a song. You know, it might even like be like, yeah, that's not good enough to go on the record. You know, I like the tempo. But I mean, obviously, if she played it acoustically, or like if she played it live, she could have played it slower and done it the way she wanted to. You know, that's the cool thing about touring, is that you record a track a certain way in the studio, and that's the album track. But when you play live, you can totally slow it down. And maybe live, that would work slower, you know?
Music critic Barney Hoskins expressed that he feels that Carly's actually a very underrated songwriter, and he used this song as an example. And I guess maybe he is comparing it to the likes of James Taylor and Joni Mitchell and Carole King, all these kind of songwriters we've been talking about today. Do you think that sometimes she is underrated kind of against some of those others? I guess it's difficult because we're holding her in that esteem, but do you think kind of in the bigger picture, do you think sometimes maybe she is a bit underrated against the other kinds of singer-songwriters we've talked about today?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, people always, like, when you talk about folk music and who people are influenced by, people, yeah, the go-tos are definitely Joni and James and Carole King and all of that. Carly isn't mentioned as much, you know? So I do think she probably is. Yeah, he's right. She is underrated. But I think people who know music and know the album, you know that she is up there with them, for sure. And she's not in the same pocket as them, the way I see it. You know, like, this album was more pop rock. Yeah, she came from that, like, folksy background, but she evolved as an artist, which then the others stayed very folk, you know. So she was adventurous enough to, you know, try something different, which I think the others stayed very true to the whole folk scene. So yeah, but yeah, possibly she is underrated, to answer your question. But in terms of other people, you know, I think people who know her and know the album, know the music, totally put her up there with them.
So The Right Thing to Do was actually released as the second single from No Secrets. Obviously, You're So Vain was the first. and you know, building on the success of that song. AllMusic calls it a great pop record. There's enough tension and drama, especially in the middle eight, to lift this title above most of the introspection on the album, reaching out to all the hopeless romantics who just couldn't help but relate to it. As we've said, she only released two singles from this album. I guess this, in some ways, this is obviously it's a very much a hypothetical question. I guess, one, was it the right choice for the second single? Like, do you think it's a strong single? And two, are there any other songs on the album that you might have maybe plumped for rather than this?
Gosh, the second single is you know, that I always have a deliberation over what's first single, what's second single. You should save the best for, like, the third single. You kind of want to whet the public's appetite. You know, it has to be a good enough song to get people curious about you and play it, but it shouldn't be your best song. So it's that's a radio plugger question. that's why I go to my radio plugger. I'm like, what do you think?
Yeah.
Because I know I love all of them. Yeah, I think when you're really attached, all your songs are your babies. So Carly would have been, she probably would have wanted all of them to be the first single or the best single, you know. And I think that's what's special about this album, by the way, is that every song, not every song may have been a radio friendly track, as in what radio pluggers would see as a radio friendly track. But then you think back to the days Pink Floyd, when they released, you know, 8-9 minute songs and they were played on the radio back in the day when that did still happen. You know, there wasn't any, you can break the rules, you know, there are rules that they tell you, but if it's a great song, it's a great song, you know, and that's what it boils down to me. If it's lyrically great, melodically great, the tempo's right, the production's good, it doesn't overpower the vocals, the bass line is still heavy and it's still in there and it's all very real. I think that's what it really boils down to. But I just think that lyrically, this song was a great opener. I think that as a second single as well, I think it's just everyone can relate to it, you know, loving you's the right thing to do. You know, it's just like, it's just, you know, I think it's a universal kind of theme, you know, it makes you feel good. So I think lyrically, I would base it more on the lyrics that, yeah.
So let's move on to the Carter Family. So this is one of two songs on the album written by Carly and lyricist Jacob Brackman. So it sounds like they've had a long positive friendship since they met in 1968. Many songs across Carly's career were kind of written by the two of them. And I think from what it sounds like, in those instances, she handles the music and he handles the lyrics. Again, in terms of that career and kind of looking across it, how important has their friendship and partnership been over the years on Carly's career?
To be honest, I'm not too familiar with their relationship, but I can just say that obviously whenever you have people in your life, whoever's around you on a day-to-day basis or like a long-term friendship like Carly had with him, it would be, especially someone that you write with, you develop some sort of like shorthand, you understand each other, you don't have to explain things to them. So I think that would have been very influential on her, and you feel very comfortable with that person. So she would have been, obviously she kept writing with him, so it was a very, they wrote great songs together and she felt very comfortable. And I just think that has a huge influence on how the song comes out, instead of like a session like they were doing in Nashville where you don't know the person, you just, you know, you're set up with three sessions a day, you've got an hour to write a song, and it's very business orientated and it's very sterile kind of the environment, you literally go into an office. Whereas someone like this with Carly, they would have written at her home or his home, or do you know what I mean? Or it would have been very personal, you know, the stories that they were saying and how they would have written the record. And they wouldn't have been afraid to tell each other, that's just total crap. Let's rewrite that, you know, like, but when you're without someone that you don't know, you kind of have to filter what you say. So sometimes the song suffers because of that, because you don't feel that you can be completely honest with the person you're collaborating with. So collaborations are huge. I mean, every great artist, if they've collaborated and it's been a successful song, you normally they've had great friendships, you know, especially in the singer-songwriter zone.
Yeah. And interesting when you're talking about the kind of the great collaborations and that kind of thing. So the Carter Family was actually singled out in many reviews around the time the album was released. I've got a review from Hi-Fi News and Record Review, who said at the time, the Carter Family has the quality of Lennon and McCartney at their finest, which is a really bold claim when you think about kind of the body of work of Lennon and McCartney.
For sure.
Do you see where they're coming from? Would you agree with that comparison? I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, I love that comparison. I mean, that's a huge compliment as well to her. I think because the Carter Family was definitely a story, you know, instead of it being like lyrically about a relationship that she had, it was a story from start to end. Like, that could have been just spoken word as a story, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Which goes back to, I mean, old country songs, you know, old country songs are based in stories. It has you know, this person did this and this man went here and they went on a traveling journey. And yeah, it could be, it's like a short book, it's like a short story in its own, it can stand on its own as a story. So I think that's the difference with the Carter family, is that it was, yeah, lyrically it's definitely about a story, and you want to listen to the whole story till the end. And I personally, I think that songs that are stories are the strongest songs. Like, I love that. I just think, I think singer-songwriters are storytellers, and that's when they're doing their finest work. So yeah.
And I think obviously the message of this song is really strong. And again, like you say, perhaps if it's coming from experience, and obviously very much with the next song, there's a lot of, so what's this about? Who's this about? The interpretation with the Carter family, the message of the song that I get from it essentially is, you know, you don't know what you've got until it's gone. You know, that you, all these kind of people yeah. in her life who then move on. And at the time she's like, well, you know, that's fine. But then once they're gone, you know, that's something that's really, really difficult. And I think that's the strength of Carly and Jacob Brackman too, I guess, that, you know, these kinds of themes are timeless. And when we're talking about this album, it's because a lot of the songs, we can resonate so strongly with them because it's so easy to take on board the message and relate it to our own lives, I guess.
Absolutely. And that's the thing when you're talking about like core emotions and like, you know, what, how you felt in your life growing up, you know, the family next door, or, you know, like in the Carter family, it's their core emotions that we will feel forever, that human beings have felt from day one and will continue to feel. And when they're so universal, that makes it timeless. And when it's said in a you know, a very good way, in a poetic way, in a stylized way, I think that never will cease to be, you know, resonating. That will never cease to resonate with people, because it just, you can still apply it to your relationships today and your life today.
Definitely. And I think to move on from that a little bit, the 70s were very much a time of, as you say, very much around female empowerment, this kind of sexual liberation. And I think Carly's role in that's often very underplayed. Again, when you think about the kind of people that we remember from the 70s and that are kind of talked about all the time, I think Carly is often underplayed in that. In a song like this, for instance, she uses lyrics like, "You used to make me moan in bed," and yet that doesn't sound salacious or tacky, or, you know, in a way that perhaps in the 80s, when some of the pop stars were coming through and they were using sex in their music, it was in a much more tacky way. Whereas I think that Carly's using it in this way that's just a lot more honest and just kind of where she's at. But you've got to think, at the time, lyrics like that, like "You used to make me moan in bed," were probably quite a big deal at the time.
Yeah, gosh, yeah, absolutely. At the time, that would have rocked a few feathers. I mean, I'm sure songwriters, you know, they would look back at songs they released back then and go, gosh, I wouldn't release that now. Or not, I wouldn't say it in the same way now, you know, because even if it's accepted, it could be, you know, it's just not said, you know, like, you don't say things like that, you just don't, you know. But at the time, I think, yeah, the 70s, because everyone was breaking the rules and challenging the narrative, and it was the time to do that. And so it was very much embraced by the public to do that, and respected and encouraged, because it inspired, like you said, you know, that female movement at the time. Mm-hmm. So I love that line, by the way. I think it's great.
And I think, you know, I was, so again, obviously, as I was doing my research, I'd read this whole bit, and it was basically about kind of Taylor Swift's love of Carly Simon, and what it kind of said towards the end was that she was kind of the archetype of the breakup song. And I felt like that was a real disservice to her songwriting, because I think that she goes past that trope sometimes. So, you know, perhaps a lot of people were writing those kinds of songs around that time for her, and obviously we're moving on to a perfect example next. You know, it was going beyond that, and rather than it being, you know, "My relationship's over, woe is me, I'll never love again," there's this much more kind of empowered side of it coming out, where it's like, look, this is me, and I'm happy in my skin, and I'm happy who I am, and you can hit the road.
Yeah, totally. It's exactly that. I wouldn't agree with Taylor's description at all. I think the whole album is different stories, different stages of a relationship, and it's not, you know, it's not the breakup song at all. Like, "You're So Vain" is like exactly what we'll talk about next. Is, you know, it's a completely different point of view on relationships and on men. So yeah, I wouldn't agree with that statement at all. I think Carly just wrote a very honest record, and different stages and different aspects of relationships. They're not all breakup songs.
And so far so good from a chat with Noosh Gaughan about the breakthrough album from Carly Simon, No Secrets. And we will get back to my chat with Noosh in just a little bit. As always, we're going to go through every track on the album. We're going to dig in track by track. Noosh's latest album, Hey Sicko, is out now. She's very excited for people to hear it. An album that's 10 years in the making. Really great album. Really enjoyed listening to it. And we had a bit of a chat kind of after our conversation about the album and songs that she particularly liked and that I thought really kind of tied in nicely with that album that we've been talking about today in No Secrets. And here is a song from the album. I'm really excited for you all to hear it. I love it when I get to play music on the podcast. Here is Nu Skaugen with a song from her new album, Hey Sicko. This is Rebels and Foes.
Rebels and foes, thorns in a row, holes, mega pieces of my road. I found a priest, he said I'll absolve you of all the dirty things you've done while cleaning up his shiny gun. I loved a man who gave me his old guitar in New York City. She's still playing pretty. Rebels and foes, thorns in a rose, mega pieces of my road. Cowboys and free, lovers and creeps, walking on my broken dreams. Kiss a drum, say we're God's big joke, and offer me a shot of whiskey to listen to my sad story.
Move on to Your Soul Vein. It seems like a really good time to do so. Arguably her most well-known song, unless you're a James Bond fan. I think Your Soul Vein started life as a song called Bless You Ben, but then she shelved it. She felt like lyrically it wasn't really working, and then one night at a party she sees this male guest arrive with so much kind of swagger and stuff that it's like he was walking onto a yacht, and that thought pops into her head and the song's born. So obviously we're going to dig into this a fair bit, but before we do, what are your general thoughts on this song before we kind of really dig into it?
Wow, this is like my favorite song on the record. I think it's just such a cool song. Called, like, she just calls it, you know. She hasn't said, oh, I can't say that, I can't do this, I can't do that. And the way she describes it, and the lyrics that she's chosen as well. I mean, obviously, when things happen to you in real life, sometimes it couldn't have been more perfect. You literally write down what happened, like how she describes the apricot scarf and the way he tilted his hat, you know. And I just think that when things are so descriptive, you can listen to it and you literally see it happening. You know what I mean? And I think those are amazing songs when the listener can just be like, it's kind of like watching a movie. Do you know what I mean? You listen to the song, the music transports you anyway, because it supports the lyrics. And then the lyrics, you just listen to it and you literally have your own film going on in your head, you know, and you can see it happening. Like, you can see the type of guy that would do that, you know. we know all those types of guys that just have this like oozing charisma and confidence and just walk in, and she encapsulates that so well with this song. And it's just, and the bass line is just so freaking good. It's just, I love this bass line on it, and it's such an integral part of the song. I mean, you hear that bass line, you know what song it is. Do you know what I mean? Like, immediately, as soon as you hear that, like, those first few notes. So, yeah, I just think this is for me personally, this is my favourite song on the record. It's got edge to it. It's got a vibe. It's got attitude. It's got confidence. It, you know, and you can just totally just be there with her as she sees this person walk in. It's awesome.
Yeah. And for obviously, talking about the bass line, that intro, it's so, as you said, so iconic, you know, instantly, what you're listening to, the moment you hear it. From Klaus Voormann, he says of that intro, we were all in the studio and I tinkled on my bass when Carly suddenly shouted, I want this as an intro. If you listen, she murmurs in the background while I play the intro, son of a gun, and it was a damn fine compliment. And I love how sometimes the most memorable moments in music like that, you know, sometimes, you know, that was probably never meant to happen. It almost kind of happened by accident. But then, as we're saying, you know, this is a really integral part of the song now.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the best things in the studios that end up on the record are often not planned at all, like exactly like that. He's just playing on his bass and Richard walks in and he's like, what was that? What are you playing? He's like, oh, I'm just like, you know, just exercising my fingers, you know, just warming up before we get into the like the room. And just like, no, that's fucking brilliant. Let's just keep that. That's, you know, and it, you don't, you just have a sense or a gut instinct at the time that that is just so important to the song. And like you said, it became iconic. Like, you just hear that bass line and people know what it is. But yeah, that's not planned. And that happens so many times. That's why you have to let things happen sometimes. It can't be too planned. You can have a schedule or an idea of what you guys want to do. But until you get into the studio and, you know, you start vibing, you start doing it. And it's really good to have the time to do that, you know, which I think is sometimes hard with some projects. You have so little time. But when you have the time, like back in the day, they made great records because of that. They had the time to sit there and rehearse. They had the time to discuss it and chat with the producer. They did so much pre-production on the record, you know, until you actually go in and record it. It's not like a country record where the guys get all the sheet music and the diamonds and where they're going to go. And you just go in and play a very clinical, yeah, everything's pitch perfect and everything is like as it's written down, but there's no magic. And especially in like rock and roll records, you know, like the guitar licks is not necessarily perfect. Yeah, there's one song on here where the solo was is it the solo in this song? He did one take on it or something and he wanted to do more takes. And then Richard's like, no, that's perfect. You're done. So yeah, and sometimes you just want that. It's not sterilely, you know, clinically perfect, because we don't want to listen to that. We want to have that human feel to it. We want to feel that it's a real human being that we're listening to, you know, that is like actually playing this and you feel like you're in the room with the band. And I think that's what this does, you know. So yeah, those magical moments, those mistakes, as you know, you initially call them, they're not mistakes. They're like, they're so necessary to making a great record, and so much that you had no idea. Like when you write a song, like I've written stuff, you have no idea what the guys are going to do when you get in there. And sometimes like this song, that bass line is just like that. Without that bass line in You're So Vain, it wouldn't be the same song, you know, like if he hadn't have done that.
Yeah. Now, there's been so much debate over the years as to who You're So Vain is about. And I think Carly's gone back and forth over the years as to whether the song is about one man or if it's kind of a mix of a few men that have been in her life. People have talked about the likes of it being about David Bowie, Cat Stevens. The most famous theory is that the song's about her ex-partner, actor Warren Beatty. And I think this is part of the charm of the song because, you know, it's like you'd said a few minutes ago, we all know a man like this. We all know someone like this who just has that confidence and, you know, thinks that kind of the sun shines off their backside and all of that kind of stuff. But we can connect that song to whoever we want. And by her keeping her cards close to her chest, she allows us to do that. It can be about whoever we want it to be, or we can speculate who she's written it about. It just kind of creates this mythology, I guess, around the song.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think, you're always like, because when it's a singer-songwriter and they're performing their own songs, it's like, yeah, you know that it comes from sort of real life experience and real life relationships. So I think, yeah, this song, I think she said, though, that the second verse, she admitted at some point that it was about Warren Beatty, but she said only the second verse. Like, so that's the thing, because you can incorporate, you can mix experiences. Like, so maybe one verse was about James Taylor, you know, the second one was about Warren Beatty, and the third one was, you know, a different guy. I think that's the mystery about it. And I'm really happy she never kind of said who it was about in all three verses, you know, in the whole of the song. It's like, I'll give you one verse, but the rest of it is going to have to remain a mystery. And I think you need mystery. Do you know what I mean? You don't want to know. We do want to know, but it's kind of cool not to know as well. You know, it's like, it maintains that mystery around the artist, which I think we've kind of lost nowadays. People want to know everything and, you know, want to know when you're brushing your teeth and like doing really mundane things. So I think that maintaining that mystery, and that was what was so beautiful about that era, is that there was this mystery about what they were writing about and, you know, who they were. And yeah, it's cool not to know who the other verses are about. But yeah, we can take a stab at who they were about, for sure.
I think even that chorus is just, it's just a fantastic piece of songwriting. So Warren Beatty actually spoke out in 2007 and he was like, let's be honest, the song's about me, which is like the ultimate irony, because it's kind of, Carly's addressing that subject, you know, you're so vain, you think this song is about you. The song is about them. So it almost kind of goes around in a circle, and I love the irony of that. And as you'd said, I think she has admitted that the second verse is about Warren, but kind of kept her cards close to her chest with regards to the rest of the song.
Yeah, which is cool. I'm glad she did that, you know. She caved under a bit of pressure just to talk about one verse, but she was like, you're gonna have to keep guessing about the other verses.
So another potential candidate who Carly's actually denied that it is about this person, but another potential candidate actually appears on the song on backing vocals, and that's Mick Jagger. So Mick's actually uncredited on the track by his request. He didn't want to be credited, but when you listen to it, so it's one of those things, obviously, this song's kind of just woven into pop culture, you know. I'd probably heard it before I even knew who Carly Simon was when I was a kid. Once you learn that Mick Jagger's on there and you listen to it, you're like, of course he is. Like, he's blatantly there. Yeah. He's not the last guest star we're going to hear on the album, but it seems like the early 70s was such a collaborative and almost like a fertile time where the people kind of just dropping in on each other's albums, like it was just nothing. And it's like you say, perhaps, you know, things have moved on from that now, that I just really like the fact that, you know, as again, we'll get, when we get into Night Owl later on, it's like, oh, well, so-and-so's on this track, and just people dropping in and out of each other's albums. It just seems like a really exciting and collaborative time to be working in music.
Yeah, totally. I think it was just like the 70s was like that free love, that movement, like friends, everyone was friends, everyone knew each other on the music scene. You know, they had that whole Laurel Canyon scene where people would just like pop around each other's houses and just play, you know. It was, and that's what music's about for me. It was just, you know, like, you know, you pick up a guitar and just jam one night with your friends, and your friends happen to be the Beach Boys, or, you know, it's just like, that was what was so cool about the 70s, I think. Yeah, and it makes the difference on the record, even if Mick didn't want to be credited. I mean, you can clearly hear that it's him on BB's. So, and it just adds that flavor to the song. Like, you didn't know it, like you said, you don't know it when you listen to it, but then when you know it's him, you're like, yeah, it's definitely him. And without him, exactly, like, all those ingredients, would it have been such a successful song without all those like haphazard, just like things happening, you know, chance mistakes or chance bass lines or Mick on the vocals? It all just kind of came together and created this very special song. And I think that time was amazing to be a musician. I wish we were like that now, you know. Everything's just so much more controlled now. I think you can still find it in pocket depending where you are, but yeah, there's just so, it was just a different time, you know, different points of view, different vibes. People weren't as kind of just like solely focused on their projects, you know what I mean? Everyone would collaborate, and that was, they knew that was what music was about. And I think we have kind of lost that collaboration thing, which is a shame, but hopefully it will come back one day.
Now, in that Classic Albums documentary that we've talked about, Richard Perry states that when, after Mick and Carly had finished the backing vocals together, and these are his exact words, that Carly was so turned on that she has to re-record the lead vocal. And that's the vocal that we hear, like, on the track. Carly wrote in, I think she wrote this in her memoirs, but it's also in an article on iloveclassicrock.com, that there was a great electricity between them, making her nervous and drawing her closer to husband singer-songwriter James Taylor out of fear of possibly pursuing something she shouldn't. So this idea of maybe thinking, oh, this electricity with Mick is something that I wasn't expecting, and sort of pulling back, and that's why they never really collaborated much more than that. And we're going to talk a little bit about, again, the impact that some of that actually had later on. Do you hear a kind of a, I guess it's difficult kind of, you know, we've talked about the makeup of the track. Is there a sense of like a chemistry between their two vocals on that backing track, or is that something that you think is maybe hard to spot in the finished product?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, you can tell that they vibe and they work together. It's hard to spot like that she was like turned on just from the vocals. But I do think that, yeah, when you are vibing with someone, especially on vocals, man, that's just such a like personal thing, and it's coming from your gut, you know, like the two flavors of the vocals need to blend together, and that's nothing to do with like energy or if you're vibing or you're turned on by the other person. But I think the energy that she had because of that, I think that, and I think she did this in one take after that, like she went in and did the whole vocals in one take because of the vibe, you know, she was like you said, she was turned on. That's what maybe made the vocals what it is, because they ended up using that cut on the record of her vocals. And doing it in one take like that is just like, that's the way it should be done anyway. By the way, not cut and pasted in Pro Tools, which is what everyone does. Yeah, because there's a flow to it, you know. So I think the fact that Mick was there, he completely affected the record, because in essence, it was because he was there and they sang together. So she went back into the studio in the room and said, I want to do it again. And she did it all in one take because she was coming off the vibe of Mick. Do you know what I mean? And Mick obviously has that rock and roll energy about him, you know, which has affected her. So the vocals wouldn't have been the same, you know? And it's not something you can put your finger on either. It's like you listen to it and you just feel it in your bones. When you're sitting in the studio, you're like, yeah, that's the take. You just feel it. You know, there's, yeah, energetically it works. So yeah, I think that's where I see it more, is in the lead vocal.
And you said something there that's, I'm going to come back to later on, which is really interesting, when you'd said about Mick's kind of impact on the record, which again, yeah. Again, I'll talk about that in a few songs time, but that's really interesting that you've put it like that. So You're So Vain was chosen as the first single. Carly expressed when, and did you say that you think that the first time you may have heard it was when you were in a car? Did you say that near the beginning?
Yeah,
of the chat?
I couldn't remember, but as we're going into it, because I'm definitely thinking it was radio. That's where I would have heard it.
Yeah, so really interestingly, the first time that Carly heard it kind of outside of the studio when she got back to New York was in the back of a taxi, and she was so pleased with how good it sounded on the radio. She was like, this sounds perfect on the radio. Beyond kind of the curiosity about who it's about and all these theories of who it is, why do you think this song has endured for as long as it has, over 40 years at this point?
It's just a bloody good song. I mean, it's like so many things have to come together that are not under our control to make a song a hit song. Like, it can be a hit song lyrically, or it can be a hit song like you've got a great riff going on to it, but like, or the bass is phenomenal, you've got this like key signature drum, you know, solo, you know, like Fleetwood Mac has a lot of that, you know, but one thing on its own doesn't make it a hit song, you know. It's so many elements that need to come together, and this, you know, that you can't control, that are kind of from external forces, you know what I mean? Like, it depends, like, if Mick wants to drop into the studio that day, or he just happened to be in the neighbourhood, you know, she's like, oh, you want to, you know, have a go on the BBs, you know, and, like, I think that you can't control those things. So I think that all those ingredients that went into the record, that some were orchestrated and some weren't, has made it this song that it's just great musically, and so, and it can be played on the radio, it's just very commercially friendly. You know, it resonates with everyone. It's every girl loves to sing this. I mean, it's in that movie, what's that movie, 10 Ways to Lose a Guy or something like that. Anyway, lots of movies have used it, you know, because it's that female empowerment song. It is the female empowerment song on the record for me. Like, you come out and you just like, yeah, I'm good with who I am and I don't need you, you know what I mean? It's like, I don't need a man by my side, I'm a strong independent woman. And so, I mean, every woman can relate to that, you know. It's, it makes you feel good and makes you feel inspired. So that will never go away. And that's why I think this song will always be a timeless song that anyone can relate to.
So let's move on now to "Is Friends Are More Than Fond of Robin." So a more gentle moment on the album. Obviously, we've had this really kind of big hit. We're dialing back on kind of the bells and whistles. This is a bit more nice, a bit more simple. Do you think that kind of simplicity, and we're going to talk maybe a little as to why this song is maybe a bit more simple, but do you think that helps it stand out against tracks like "You're So Vain" and "Night Owl" coming later on, that have less of that Richard Perry sheen on them?
Yeah, I think, well, these are probably ones truer to who Carly you know, what Carly would do on her own without Richard's kind of rock and roll influence. But some songs don't warrant it. Like, you know, like this is clearly a very standalone song that's, you know, very honest and very vulnerable and very personal. And sometimes you don't want like distracting, like huge, like musical riffs and bass lines going into it because you want the lyrics to really stand out. That's how I approach it. I just feel that this is obviously a very personal song to her. So the lyrics have to lead. Do you know what I mean? Like it's a thing. You don't want to distract focus away from the lyrics on a song like this. So it and it's a nice, you know, art coming off You're So Vain going into this song as well. I just think you don't want to be, you know, constantly in people's faces when they're listening to a record. You want to take them on a journey. So it's nice just to take it down a notch or two on this one, you know, and just let's have a more chilled out song, a more personal song. Just keep people going on this journey with you. So I think this song is perfectly placed on the record.
So Carly said in the past, and this might give us a bit of an understanding as to why there is maybe a little less kind of influence from Richard. She said he was often 4 to 5 hours late in the studio. So rather than wait for him to arrive, she would just find her own space to go, you know, and that the song, she says the song was written very quickly. And she said to him, Richard, if you're going to be late, I'm going to do what I want to do, which kind of echoes the way that he was talking to people when he first came into the project. Richard loved the song. Here we are talking about it today. I almost feel like, and I know that you'll certainly resonate with this when we're talking about kind of the albums that you enjoy. In my head, this idea of Carly kind of going into her own space, writing this song, kind of writing it really quickly, it makes me think about how Stevie Nicks wrote Dreams in the room as sessions, that she just took herself away, went into this room and thought, you know what, I'm just going to have this own space, I'm going to come back when I'm ready. And there seems very much kind of a parallel between the two. And I know obviously that Stevie Nicks is someone who you really admire as
Absolutely.
Well. I found a really interesting blog post about this song from a blog called Songs From So Deep. And they say about the song, wisely, Perry lets his friends are more than fond of Robin breathe. And Simon responded with what must be her best released vocal performance. So that's another big statement we've got there. In a long and celebrated career like she's had, is it up there? Is it her best vocal performance? Is it certainly one of them?
I mean, it's a great vocal performance. I mean, it's very hard to like say this was her best vocal performance. I think that, like I said, each song warrants a particular kind of vocal performance. You know, this is a more, you know, just a quieter, more personal, it's more of an intimate song, musically and lyrically. So you can't really compare that to, you know, the stronger songs, you know, the more like upbeat songs like You're So Vain or The Right Thing to Do. They have different flavours. So yeah, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that statement. I think they're all great in their own way, you know?
Yeah. Let's move on to We Have No Secrets, which is, it's kind of the title track of sorts. Obviously, yeah. There is a slight difference there. A song essentially about honesty, I guess. So when reviewing the album for Rolling Stone shortly after it came out, Stephen Holden identified We Have No Secrets as exemplifying the theme of No Secrets, the album. Difficulty of being happy by painfully expressing the realisation that emotion and rationalisation are often irreconcilable. How important, you know, would you agree that this song does kind of sum up a lot of the themes on the album? Is it an important track on the album?
Like, yeah, I think the main message of the song is honesty, to be honest in relationship, even if it's going to hurt, you know, to know the truth. Do we want to know the truth or would we rather live in denial and live in our own little bubble? And I think that, I think it was a good song to make the title track. You know, if you want to say it's because the album's called No Secrets, it's obviously come from there. It does. And that's the tricky thing about choosing a album title is that it's got to encompass the whole journey of the album and what the message you want to give as an artist. You know what I mean? People are only going to pick up, oh, that's the name of the album, that's the artist. And if they know the artist, great. But they're going to be like, well, what's the album about? And you kind of have to grab them and find a way to say, this is the message that I want to give from this piece of work. So, yeah, I do think that it was a good choice in terms of the album, because the album's about honesty. And it's not a breakup song, you know, it's just saying this is, for me anyway, it's more like this is where we're at, we're being honest, and sometimes it hurts. But, you know, I think you'd rather know the truth than not, you know, and the whole song is about being honest and being vulnerable and being personal, being intimate and being strong on your own. So you've got to have that kind of flavour, those mix of songs to create that. So, yeah, I think it's a good title track for the album.
So I'd said this to you, obviously, before we started, but when I'm not kind of doing my classic album, that I work in mental health. And interestingly, this song came up in a book that I was reading about self-disclosure in psychotherapy.
Wow.
I'm just going to read you kind of the quote from that book. It said, her words in the song suggest that although she knows her love better when he shares his past, the price paid for the knowledge is too high. Indeed, she laments, it's often better never to have known these secrets at all. And this is kind of what you were saying. This is almost like an all too familiar part of kind of being human, you know, do we want to know everything, warts and all? Part of us does, but kind of what's the price for that? What's the price that we're paying? And I think that, you know, this is a really good example of how her songwriting is so relatable. It is so accessible that she's exploring things that we all know, you know, yeah, that we've all felt.
Definitely. Yeah, exactly. And that's why everyone can relate to it. You know, even if you haven't been, you know, brave enough to like put it out there, when someone, and that's the job of artists, is that, you know, you pave the way, or you show people how, you know, it can be very liberating, to be honest, like that, and show, you know, the dark side, the good side. You know, we've all got dark and light in us, and, you know, like you said, the pretty parts and the not so pretty parts, and being willing to say, this is who I am, and take it or leave it kind of deal, you know, and I'm comfortable with it. I think that's the constant battle, isn't it, of human existence. Going forward, you're constantly trying to battle with yourself and your ego, and what you should do, what you shouldn't do, what you should look like, what you shouldn't look like. And just when you get to that point of being comfortable in your skin, and that's also what I think this album is about, is being comfortable in your skin, saying it in some of the songs, but also just doing it and doing, you know, being able to say what you think and how you feel. That is a huge thing to do.
And in Girls Like Us, which was the book we touched on earlier, the one about Carly and Joni and Carol, the author Sheila Weller cites the line, "You always answer my questions, but they don't always answer my prayers," as highlighting the supposed desirability of open, non-monogamous marriages and the reality that actually people want to be their lover's sole partner. So this kind of counterbalance of people thinking, oh, well, you know what? You know, are we meant to be monogamous with the thing? And actually, you know what? I am happy with this person that I'm with, and, you know, I want one love. Before her marriage to James Taylor, which we've said, from what I can gather, was kind of shortly after the recording of this album, Carly had apparently had affairs with the producers of her first two albums, and she'd actually made a pact that wouldn't happen with Richard Perry while recording No Secrets. I think it may even have been kind of a written contract that they drew up together. So I guess that she's juggled emotionally with a lot of the issues expressed in this song, you know, so it very much, it comes from the heart.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely comes from the heart. And exactly. I think, didn't she say she wrote it like just before she was leaving for London or something? Like, they had this really honest conversation about stuff, and yeah, and posing that whole question about serial monogamy, serial relationships, you know, obviously she's having the relationships that she had with the producers before. I mean, it's a constant question, isn't it, that people ask, are we meant to be like monogamous, or are we meant to, like, you know, just be free spirits? And I love the fact that she poses that question, you know, and she's obviously like deliberating it herself in her head. And then like I said, sometimes the best medicine as a songwriter is just to put it down in a song, because you're like, I've got to get this out. And it's medicine for the soul as a songwriter, and if it rings true for you, it's going to ring true for other people. So yeah, I think she was asking herself a lot of questions at that point.
So let's move on to one of my favorite songs on the album, opening up side two, which is Embrace Me You Child. Carly revealed on Classic Albums that the song came after a period of writer's block. Now this is, I remember you saying kind of at some point during our chat about not getting too, if you get too into your head, that can happen, and that we, you know, you can get into this point where you're just kind of stuck. And again, talking about kind of contracts and documents, Carly turned to a guitarist, Jimmy Ryan, and had him draft a document with her that she was to have a song written by the end of the week, regardless of if it was the greatest song ever or something absolutely rubbish. And Embrace Me You Child was born as a result of that. So Jimmy kind of helped her out of that writer's block. What are your thoughts on the song? And would you agree with me? Do you think it is a highlight of the album?
Yeah, I mean, I love this song. This is, it's a great, great song. And sometimes when you're forced to write a song, like I said, it can be very tricky, because you're like, you have that writer's block, and it's really, really hard to get out of it, especially when you know you're under a deadline, you've got pressure, you've got the studio going, you've got the producer saying we need a song, you know, the pressure sometimes isn't the best medicine when you've got a few more songs to put on the record. But yeah, she clearly did it, and it's got like this like massive octave jump in the chorus, which is like, I just think it's, I mean, I would never do that. I think it's very daring. I mean, you've got to be able to like, really like that kind of style of writing and that style of like singing. I think it, but it's obviously, you know, it's different effects, it's like a sound effect essentially, but it totally works for this song. And Carly clearly, you know, she wanted to do it, and it sounds great. And I think that's what also makes the song, like there's moments when it's very different to another song, you know, it's not your traditional melody, so to speak. It kind of like surprises you, you know. But yeah, it is one of the great songs on the record.
And I think it's interesting when you're talking about it being different. I know Bill Schnee, who engineered the album, he'd said when it got to this point of mixing the album, it really represents a shift for him, and he wasn't expecting anything like this on the album. Do you think it is to do with that kind of that the vocal element of it that makes it, as he calls it, an explosive and amazing song? You know, do you think it is that vocal element of it that kind of helps it stand out from other tracks on the album?
Yeah, definitely, because it doesn't sound vocally like the rest of the tracks. It's like it's got a very different vibe to it melodically because of that octave jump. So yeah, definitely, that's one of the things that makes it really stand out.
So music critic Robert Christgau, who he's not always the most positive when he's talking about Carly Simon, in all fairness. What he did say in something I'd read, he'd said, "In the name of honesty, the name of what is fair, I have to admit that Simon's third album, No Secrets, is much superior to the first two. Significantly, Embrace Me, You Child, a song about how good her own family was for her, works best." Is this the kind of stuff, you know, it sounds like the kind of stuff we've been discussing is what's making it stand out, even to someone who doesn't particularly like Carly Simon's music. He's able to take this song and be like, you know what, actually, this is a good song. I can accept that that actually, you know, this is one that stands out.
Yeah, well, critics are really hard to please.
Yeah.
they're called critics. I mean, the very word is critical. It comes from critical. So, yeah, I mean, the fact that he liked the song and he's not necessarily a big fan of her work, yeah, it definitely speaks words, you know. I think the fact as well, it's like the rest of the songs on the record, it's so personal. Like, it's about her father, you know, and the lack of love that she had there. And it's very daring to put that down and put that out there in the world and be open with your own family history. And I think that's what makes it a great song, is because she's so vulnerable in it that you can't help but be drawn into it.
Yeah, and I don't know if I'm maybe misunderstanding that quote from Robert there, but he'd said that the song's about how good her own family was for her. And yet for me, again, you know, I get it. Obviously, it's very much about a relationship with her father. And a quote that I've heard from Carly in the past is that the song is a scream of anguish for my father to be with me, which kind of goes very against what he says, unless I'm kind of misunderstanding how he's written that. I think it is arguably Carly at her most vulnerable at this point in the album.
Yeah. I don't know where he got that from.
No.
Because that's not what the song's about. Like, yeah, it's a scream. Yeah, it is a scream of anguish, you know, like just expressing how the lack of love that she had and the disappointment that she had not having her dad's love, you know, drove her into these serial relationships. And yeah, what he says doesn't really correlate. Maybe we're misunderstanding what he said.
yeah, possibly. So let's move on to Waited So Long. This is, as we're getting towards the end of the album, some of these songs are a bit less talked about than others. So there is certainly a lot less information out there about Waited So Long in comparison to other songs on No Secrets. I mean, what are your thoughts on this? You know, do you think it is perhaps like a deep cut or maybe a bit more of an underrated song on the album, perhaps?
I think some tracks are just more accessible and more radio friendly. And it just, you never know which ones are going to be those songs. You can have a feeling and a vibe when you're in the studio, when you're cutting the record, but you don't really know. And it doesn't mean that it didn't, you know, doesn't warrant the song on the record. It's just some songs just reach out to other people and you have no idea sometimes. So no, I think it's a very warranted song on the record. Maybe not as radio friendly as You're So Vain. Do you know what I mean? But it's definitely, it fits in with the journey of the record and where they put it. And I think it's a great song.
So like other moments on the album we've talked about, I feel like Waited So Long is a song about sexual awakening in some way. So we were talking about You Used To Make Me Moan In Bed on the Carter Family. You know, Waited So Long has lyrics including, "Daddy, I'm no virgin, but I've already waited so long." And it seems to be this delicate balance that we've talked about throughout between Carly expressing her femininity, her sexuality, which was quite revolutionary at the time, but doing it in a way that isn't in your face. It's not particularly kind of tawdry or vulgar. It's just her expressing who she is as a woman. Do you think, and we've talked about her maybe as a songwriter being underrated, do you think her kind of impact on the feminist movement in the 70s, which she said that she was part of, do you think that that's underplayed sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely don't hear as much about it as you should do. You know, I think she definitely did play a huge part in it at that time. Music is hugely powerful. I mean, it affects people in, even if it's subconscious ways, you know, people don't realize it, but you just feel good. You listen to a song like this and you go out and you feel like good and empowered and strong yourself, and you go out and get on with your life, you know, in your day. And sometimes you don't even realize that that was because of the song. You just feel good. But I think that she was, yeah, she definitely played a huge part in it and not necessarily recognized for it. But I think, like I said, the people in the know and the people who liked her and the people in the movement, and they definitely were aware of her. You know, she got the recognition, I think, from the people within her circle and within the movement, not necessarily on a widespread basis. But, you know, that's, you know, a lot of that is to do with, you know, media, press, you know, politics, you know, who they wanted to cover. I mean, there's so many, you know, exterior factors that don't necessarily have anything to do with the music and her as a songwriter.
So let's talk about It Was So Easy now. So this is another collaboration between Carly and Jacob Brackman. Brackman shared that Carly simply gave him a cassette with acoustic guitars and la-la-las, and he basically filled in the lyrics from that. I really like this kind of warm, almost nostalgic feeling of It Was So Easy. And again, it's perhaps one that veers a little closer to what Carly was doing before No Secrets, if you like. As we are getting towards the end of the album, and I know you said that in terms of their... you didn't know much about their kind of relationship, but do you think that their songs, so The Carter Family and It Was So Easy, do you think that they stand out amongst the rest of the album, that they are collaborations rather than ones that Carly's just written alone?
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely a different flavour to the songs that they've co-written. I mean, when it's just Carly, I think it's very much more based on, it's more of a love-based song, love-based lyric, relationship-based lyrics. I mean, these are still relationships, but they're not necessarily love relationships. This is just, exactly, you know, a feel-good song, you know, reminiscing about the past. And The Carter Family, you know, it's about a story with its own melancholy to it, you know. It's about the past again, you know, whereas the other songs on the record are much more about her current relationship.
And another guitarist, Jimmy Ryan, said that when he first heard It Was So Easy, that it reminded him of Teach Your Children Well by Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. And that influenced the solos that he played on the track. Have you heard that song? Have you heard Teach Your Children Well? And can you hear those similarities or perhaps the inspiration that Jimmy's took, certainly when he's kind of added his flavour to the song?
I can't think of the song right now in my head as you say it, but I know Crosby, Stills and Nash, obviously, the style that they do. Yeah, I mean, I can see where there's an influence for sure. But I think that she's made it her own. You know, Carly, there's still a Carly stamp to it. I mean, every great song has been influenced by other, you know, artists before or even at the same time. You know, the Beatles were influenced by the Stones and the Stones were influenced by the Beatles. You know, it was like it's like this mesh of artists at that time create the sound of that time because you're all influenced by each other. So, yeah, I can totally see the Crosby, Stills and Nash kind of, you know, ingredient going into this song, but it's still very much a Carly song for me.
Yeah. And I think, again, it's what we've been talking about, that really kind of collaborative, fertile music scene at that point that, you know, obviously, yeah, Crosby, Stills and Nash weren't necessarily involved in this song, but again, the influences, that kind of vibrant collaboration, you know, it does make sense that, you know, there might be inspiration here and there kind of in pockets on everybody's albums at that time.
Yeah, totally. Because it was all like very free and fluid. Like everyone, you know, singing, playing on everyone else's albums, or if they're not, they're jamming together at their houses, you know. So inevitably, you're going to be influencing each other, which was, I think that was so cool about the 70s melting pot, you know, the 70s whole Laurel Canyon scene. And just it created a sound of that time, you know, which you can clearly, and it's very definitive of that time. And that melting pot thing, I think it's a very, very cool thing to do.
And that brings us nicely onto Night Owl, which is another one of my favourite songs on the album. So, written by James Taylor, and I think that was released on his self-titled debut, so on his first album, Richard Perry chose that song when Carly had expressed that she wanted to cover one of James's songs on No Secrets. And I think Richard went for that because it had a slightly kind of funkier vibe than some of the more folk-based stuff that James had done. Have you heard James's version of Night Owl? And how does it differ to what Carly kind of comes up with on No Secrets?
God, I have not heard James's version of Night Owl. How does it differ?
I guess for me, it's again, there's much more going on. It feels so, when you were saying earlier on about how this album feels very much like a collaborative album, like a group album rather than a Carly album, Night Owl encapsulates that perfectly. So the James Taylor version is very much a James Taylor song. It's very much kind of in that vibe. I feel like Night Owl's that moment, and we'll talk about some of the people on this track, where it's very collaborative. There's so many people brought in, so many influences brought in. It does feel like this kind of joint piece rather than a solo cut. And I'd hazard to think, so when I, for example, because I hadn't heard James's version before I did the research for our chat, and when I search for Night Owl, it tends to be Carly's version that comes up first. It doesn't tend to be James's version. So I imagine that, you know, that's evidence enough that she really made the song her own.
Yeah, for sure. If that comes, yeah, you don't really find, yeah, because I didn't know. I haven't heard his version at all. So, yeah, I mean, you associate Night Owl with her.
Yeah.
Which is a cool thing. It's always, I mean, obviously, they're, you know, they're husband and wife. So it's, you know, they shared and collaborated. I mean, it's a very cool thing that she did one of his songs, cut one of his songs on a record. I think that's the cool thing to do. But she definitely made it her own, for sure, which I think is really important as well when you're doing a record. Like, if you are going to cover someone else's song, even if it's your husband's, you know, it still has to fit in with the whole energy of the record, because otherwise it's very jolting, you know. Like, if you listen to the record as it should be listened to, start to finish, you're going to suddenly have this jolt that you're like, well, that doesn't feel quite right. And the listener won't know why it doesn't feel right. But unless you can make it really and completely your own, it just shouldn't be on the record. So she clearly did that and did it well.
So, you know, again, talking about some of the people on this track, Klaus Voormann's on bass again for Night Owl, Bobby Keys playing saxophone, and then most famously, Paul and Linda McCartney on backing vocals. So it feels like this real showcase moment on the album, and there's a lot of critical love for the song. James Hunter calls Carly's whooping growls a triumph. Why do you think, I think we've maybe touched on this a little bit already, I guess I was going to ask, why do you think that Carly's version gets so much love? But I guess we've already touched on that, you know, she has very much made the song her own. It is, we think of Night Owl, we think of her, we don't necessarily think of James. And yeah. Again, there's quite a few versions of this song floating around by kind of different artists. I know that James's brother recorded it too. There's obviously something about it that Carly's made that her own. And I guess I've answered my own question in that sense. Yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, when you were talking about how, and I agree with you, obviously, how cool that is that she wanted to record one of James's songs, you know, that obviously that was coming from a really sweet place, that desire backfired somewhat, because James wasn't actually a fan of the final product. And we talked earlier about Carly's connection with Mick Jagger while recording You're So Vain, and this caused some insecurity, not only with James back in America at the time, but Mick's wife Bianca. James felt that Carly's version of Night Owl, in particular, sounded like an outtake from Exile on Main Street, which had not long been released. Mick's not actually involved in the track. Biographer Stephen Davis said that James felt that Mick had left his scent on the record like a dog on a hydrant.
Wow.
I mean, I know, again, before we kind of got together and started chatting, I know that one of the other albums that you had considered was Sticky Fingers, if it hadn't already been taken. Can you hear a Rolling Stones influence on Night Owl in particular? Does it feel like it could have been on Exile on Main Street? Is there an influence going on there?
I mean, possibly, yeah. I mean, but I wouldn't. I think it boils more down to jealousy, to be honest.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like we've touched on before, everyone's influenced by everything. And she was clearly hanging out with Mick at the time, you know, and officially he hasn't been involved in this at all. But even if you're just hanging out with someone, it's going to affect your, you know, things you might want to try and things you might want to experiment. So maybe he made some suggestions to her. And there is, possibly there is an influence there, but I wouldn't say it sounds like Exile on Main Street. This is very definitely a pop rock record and a pop rock song, you know, and coming from the folk angle, you know what I mean? It's not got that rock edge and bite, but it's got a flavour to it for sure, which is inevitable. So I think his comment is more of like the jealous husband who's not able to be in London and like she's doing her thing and hanging out with her friends and who she wants to, and especially it being his song, you know, that I think that's where he felt like he had the audacity to say that. But yeah, who knows what goes on behind closed doors.
And I think from what I can gather from that same kind of biography that I was reading there, that, you know, I think it got to the point where Bianca had even rang James and said, look, my husband is sleeping with your girlfriend. And James was actually very much, well, no, I don't think they are. And he did believe her. But then obviously when she got back to America and they talked, they made that decision shortly after to get married. And I guess there's part of me that wonders how much of that was influenced by James thinking, I need to kind of snap her up before she leaves, so to speak. And I guess we'll never know. That's conjecture on my part. But I guess it is just interesting to think about the impact that friendship with Mick Jagger had on their relationship and indeed on this album.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it would affect, you know, like the people you hang out with and the people you spend time with, especially as musicians, and you're both musicians at the time, would affect your project, your music, your album, and also what you want personally in life and the people around you as well. So yeah, she clearly came back. I mean, who knows what words were spoken and stuff, and if she was or she wasn't. But yeah, I think it makes people decide, doesn't it? Makes them go, well, do I want to be with this person or not?
Yeah.
I better get married now. Or maybe you've had it on the cards for a long time. We just don't know, you know? But I think regardless of all of that, he would have had an influence on the record for sure.
And so we'll move on to the final track on the album. So again, this is one that we don't necessarily know much about, but this is When You Close Your Eyes. Again, bringing us back down again in the same way that, you know, we've had earlier in the album, kind of when the tempo picks up, bringing us another song that just kind of brings us down a little bit, chills us out after that energy of Night Owl. It seems kind of like a really nice way to bring us back down. What are your thoughts on When You Close Your Eyes in terms of that? Do you think, we've talked a lot about the placement of tracks and how important that is. How important is it that When You Close Your Eyes is the final track on the album?
I mean, I think it's a great way to close the album because it does, like I said before, the album, the record will take you on a journey and it kicks in with, you know, an upbeat track and, you know, The Right Thing to Do is like a really good opener. And then you go through this journey with, you know, the You're So Vain and We Have No Secrets and then Waited So Long and then Night Owl just before this. I think they're all very different, but they all have, you know, the flavour of the record. And this is just like, it's very much of a closing song, isn't it? It's just got this like reminiscing about the past, which is obviously one of the themes on her record, No Secrets. And just, yeah, very nostalgic and a down tempo and just like making you like feel like, it, you know, when it's done, that the record's done, you know, it's the end of that journey. I think it's very important to have those, the right opener and the right closer. It just, because you don't feel like gypped at the end of it. You're like, well, where's the next track? Mm-hmm. You kind of know that it's coming and it's, and just subconsciously and emotionally, you've gone on this emotional roller coaster with Carly through all these like emotions and relationships and times in her past and good times and bad times and her feeling good and her feeling not so good, her being really vulnerable, her being very honest. And telling intimate stories to this closing track, which is, yeah, very nostalgic and reminiscent. And yeah, it's a good way to close the album.
And I think what I like about it as well, I agree, it is almost kind of the perfect track to close the album. And I think for me, after Night Owl, which is very collaborative, it is very much, you know, so many people on it, it's this kind of big bombastic song. It's bringing that focus back to Carly and everything we love about No Secrets and all that stuff you've just said, the journey we've been on. It just seems like that perfect way to kind of wrap up the album at that point.
Yeah, totally. I think it's a perfect choice. I mean, if she wrote, she might have written it that way. Like, I need a track to close the album.
So just to kind of sum up, so No Secrets is an album that over 40 years since its release has proven more influential than anyone could have imagined or perhaps even is given credit for. So when the biggest pop star in the world, and we've touched on her a few times, when the biggest pop star in the world right now, Taylor Swift, is citing Carly Simon as a major influence, and that can be seen in her songwriting, you know this has to be regarded as a classic album. And I've got a quote here that kind of sums that up quite well from NPR. It says that one of the biggest pop stars in the world today would be fixated on a Who's Dating Who tabloid story from 1972, and that tens of thousands of her young female fans would sing along to every word of a tune that came out 40 years prior makes no sense, except that it does when you consider Carly Simon as one of the most influential artists of her generation. You're So Vain alone is not what makes No Secrets significant, but it does point to Simon's gift for getting at universal and eternal truths through personal confessions. Simon's deft storytelling, coupled with a stunningly precise vocal performance, made this album feel automatically nostalgic upon its release and absolutely timeless today. With that in mind, why do you personally think that No Secrets has stood the test of time after all these years?
I mean, a lot of what you just said, like she's been very intimate and being very confessional, do you know what I mean? And confessional in not a, like a poor me victim kind of way. It's very confessional, like owning her life, owning where she's been and owning where she's at. And it's just, it's universal. And when you touch on universal themes and then you are extremely vulnerable and very personal and intimate, and you know that's coming from the singer-songwriter, you can't help but be drawn into it no matter what walk of life you're in, what time, you know, whether it was in the 70s or now. We all have those universal themes, never change. So I think it's a strong album and will always be a strong album. I mean, good writing is good writing. You can't deny it. You know, it's not a fad. You know, it's not, you know, a drum and bass tune that happened to be a hit for one summer, you know, and it's all the one hit wonders kind of thing. She's proven herself to be a phenomenal songwriter, a phenomenal voice and a phenomenal artist, you know, and that's undeniable with this record. So it doesn't matter when you pick it up. It will always take you to that moment in time, you know, where you were listening to the record. For me, it takes me back to those days when I was, you know, listening to a lot of folk music, and it makes me feel very good and, you know, empowered, which I think is the message that she was giving people, and especially women. And it's just it's a very inspirational album, which, you know, it's rare to do that. Like I said, it's rare for all the ingredients to come together, to have the right producer, the right musicians, the right studio, the right people around you, the right, you know, the, I mean, right is probably the wrong word. There's no right or wrong, but, you know, the particular ones you have are going to make that particular sound on the record. And everyone around you can influence your energy and your sound and what you're going to write about. So it encapsulates a specific point in time for us and for her.
And finally, this is kind of the hard sell, I guess. Why is No Secrets your classic album, and why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Oh my God, if they don't know this album, you should definitely check it out. Like you said, like she's possibly been underrated. And for me, it's just one of those albums that really walks that line between great storytelling and great lyrics and great vocals and great musicianship with that edge of like great drums and great, you know, bass lines and that kind of rockier edge to it, you know, which I don't think a lot of artists were doing that back then, you know, and I don't actually know an artist is doing it now. I think she kind of brought those two elements together and made a sound that was all her own.
Well, Noosh, thank you so much for joining me on My Classic Album today to talk about this album. A great choice, and I know, again, so many of the albums that we've covered we could have talked about, but I'm really pleased that we talked about No Secrets today.
Thank you so much. It's been so fun just to talk to you about the album, and it's really, really cool to do it. So thank you for having me on the show.
Awesome stuff there. Thank you very much to Noosh Gougan for joining me on this episode of My Classic Album to chat about her chosen classic album, No Secrets, by Carly Simon. And, you know, really great chat. It's always just great to chat to someone who's so passionate about the album that they've chosen. And that's what makes this podcast so great, that even if you haven't heard an album before, there's nothing quite like hearing someone who's passionate about music talking to you about it. Thank you very much, Noosh, for joining me on the show. You heard Rebels and Foes earlier on from Noosh's latest album, Hey Sicko. Get yourself over to nooshgougan.com for all the latest information about what's going on with Noosh. The album available to stream, download, wherever you get your music. And Noosh is also a star of the E4 series Dead Pixels, which I believe is just starting to air in America. So you can watch series one there. As for us here in the UK, if you didn't catch the first series, check it out. It was so funny. I've got a feeling that that'll be, series two will be coming soon. So absolutely check that out if you want to see Noosh in action. But Hey Sicko is out now wherever you get your music, so absolutely check it out. And that's it for another episode of My Classic Album. Getting back into the swing of it after a bit of time off. Thank you very much for joining me. It's always a pleasure to know that people are listening and that people are enjoying the show. Got a big one next time, 45 Years at the Opera with Savannah Pope. Don't forget to send me your memories, your thoughts, your opinions on the album, and of course to keep voting for your favourite track from Queen's A Night at the Opera in time for our celebration in a couple of weeks' time. Looking forward to it. I'll see you then. Cheers.